You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-boned. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's sports podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, it's Neil Payne. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Neil, we usually have Kate, but this week we don't have Kate. We have an old colleague.
That's right.
Old, longtime Hot Takedown contributor. We're really excited to have Carl Bialik back in the room. Hi, Carl.
Hey, Chad. Hey, Neil.
Actually in the room also.
Carl was once a colleague of ours at 538 and is back to do a stat school. We haven't done a stat school in many moons. This is when we try and guide people through the statistics about how to measure something. We've done baseball stat schools around pitching and hitting. We've done football around passing and rushing, maybe defense as well at some point. And here today, Carl Bialik is going to take us through a tennis stat school. Carl, usually Neil is in the professor's chair. Has he given you any tips about, you know, how to make the stats cool sing?
Well, Neil really comes usually with a great battery of stats as we progress from the simple to the complex and brilliant. Tennis stats school is really fast. Tennis stats are not good. We're done. School's out.
All right.
Everyone graduated.
Episode. Great. Thank you for coming in.
End of episode.
I'm going to force you to sit a little longer. So let's start. We're going to try and measure greatness, athlete greatness in tennis. And we're going to try and progress from simplicity to complexity. So when we measure greatness, we've had a lot of conversations on this podcast about Serena Williams's greatness, for example. We sometimes talk about it as though it's a legacy for retiring athletes. When you, Carl, who is a diehard tennis aficionado, think about the simplest way to measure greatness in tennis, what pops to mind?
The number of Grand Slam titles won in your career.
Okay, so why Grand Slams?
These are the four big annual events. It's where all the best players gather. If you're healthy, or even as we're seeing in this year's Wimbledon, if you're not healthy, you try to make it onto court and to play. It's where the most ranking points are at stake, the most prize money. It's where most people are watching. In fact, I would wager that at least half and maybe more of people who watch Grand Slam tournaments in the U.S. don't really realize that there are other tournaments the rest of the year. It's really where it all happens.
Now, is this something like these tournaments got this level of, you know, distinguished status because they're just the oldest tournaments? They've kind of always been considered that way. Is it something where, like, maybe another tournament could try to get in? I think of golf, where the PGA Tour has a similar setup of Grand Slams, and they tried to get the Players Championship to try to be like another major, and it hasn't really ever taken. Is there something similar in tennis? Have we decided these are the greatest tournaments, and so they have the most ranking points, and it kind of is circular in that sense?
There's an enormous amount of circularity here. There's certainly a lot of history and a lot of prestige going all the way back with these tournaments, but it's really ebbed and flowed in terms of the individual tournaments. There was a long stretch, for instance, where many of the best players would skip Australia every year. It was really far. It was more annoying to get there than it is now. It's still pretty annoying. And especially in the amateur era, when you wouldn't have the reward of all the prize money, and it just in general, there was less money to cover all the expenses of the sport, a lot of players would skip it. And we've also had times where some of the tournaments had smaller draws than others because they just couldn't get enough players, where most of the players who entered were of that country that was hosting it. So we have had sort of unofficial fifth slams declared, but like in golf, they've never really taken hold. Sometimes people describe Indian Wells that way, sometimes Miami, but they just can't compare. They're not as big fields. There's not nearly as much international attention paid to them.
Yeah, I was going to ask how the fields kind of stack up if we're going to consider these to be sort of the be-all and end-all. Are the fields in these Grand Slams at least like significantly better than the fields in your sort of like, you know, other tournaments, your weekly, you know, rank-and-file tournaments?
So there's a tier just below the Grand Slams. For men, it's called the Masters, and for women, the Premier Tournaments. And those have, in some ways, an even tougher field. They have all the same top 50 or 60 players, and then the Slams add the next 60. Now, in golf, that would just make it harder. The more of the top players, the more of the top section of the rankings you add, the tougher it is. In tennis, you just have to beat each player you face, And sort of the more diluted the draw, the more of a chance that your draw kind of opens up, that there are more weak players who can kind of sneak through. So on pure strength alone, slams, I think, are somewhat overrated.
So Indian Wells, for example, is at a Masters and, yep. and Premier tournament, and that's one I think in the U.S. at least a lot of people have heard of,
yep.
in part because of the drama with the Williams sisters around what was racial epithets that were said to them from the crowd, I believe.
And then they skipped it for a decade
right.
or more.
So, okay, so we understand Grand Slam majors. By that metric, who is the greatest in each side of the draw on the men's and the women's side?
So we promise simplicity, but it does get a little complicated. We'll start with the simpler side. On the men's side, by that metric, it's Roger Federer. He is 18, and that's more than anyone else has won.
And still can have add to that tally.
Yep.
And so Pete Sampras, for example, who I grew up thinking was the greatest tennis player, has been surpassed by this modern wave of players. Is it just Federer that's surpassed, or has Nadal surpassed
him? Nadal, just a few weeks ago at the French Open, okay. passed Sampras.
All right, so on the men's, cut and dry. On the women's, less so?
Less so. So Serena Williams, by winning the Australian Open, won her 23rd Grand Slam singles title, and that is the most in the Open era. And the Open era is the era ever since these tournaments and the tours that surrounded them started giving out prize money. It was no longer an amateur sport. Margaret Court has the most of all time, counting the period before the Open era, the amateur era. She is 24. She won many of those titles before the Open era, and many of them at the Australian Open when it was a weaker field, when it was mostly Australian players. So most modern fans don't really consider Margaret Court's record the record to beat. But certainly if Serena Williams did beat it, there would be no need to add this layer of complexity. It would just be she is the most of all time.
Okay, I think I'm ready to progress, Neil. You feeling good?
Yeah.
The simple? All right. But before we keep going, let's get a word from this week's sponsor real quick, and then we'll come back to our conversation with Carl about tennis stats.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job, better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/takedown. That's ZipRecruiter.com/takedown. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/takedown.
Okay, so let's go to the second level of complexity. I think we should have a three-layer cake here. I would think that, I'm going to guess where you're headed, Carl, which is that we're only talking about Grand Slams. As you said, there are lots of other tournaments being played, and maybe we should be factoring those into our understanding of greatness. We wouldn't just judge an athlete in another sport by the postseason, for example. We would look at the entirety of his or her career.
In fact, sometimes we only look at regular season stats in professional sports when we're comparing all-time careers. Yeah, so there's so many other ways to measure players, and I put a whole tier of stats in this second category. And this could include total matches won, winning percentage in matches, number of titles won, weeks at number one in the rankings, because it's a weekly ranking system, total prize money, head-to-head record against your rivals. These are all things that people will point to and they say, no, Grand Slam titles are not enough to capture overall greatness.
And do those, is there a big correlation between Grand Slam titles, who's great in Grand Slam titles, and who's great in these other categories that you're offering? Because I would think that there's at least some correlation.
Oh, there's an enormous correlation, but there's still some significant differences at the top. So to take one category, Serena Williams has fewer titles than some of the women who she has more Grand Slam titles than. Part of it is that the tour used to have much weaker fields. There would just be a lot more tournaments every week and fewer women who are traveling. Part of it is that she's been very careful in her scheduling. Because there's such a modern emphasis on Grand Slam tournaments, she's really emphasized those. And even when she's entered other events, she's often not given her maximal effort. She sometimes withdraws with a small injury because she wants to be fully healed for the major. And she's had so much success since age 30 when it's been particularly important to conserve herself.
So in a way, it sounds like this kind of progression toward including more tournaments works against the way that players think in some ways, since they seem to be kind of emphasizing the majors over everything.
Well, it depends which category, and also depends which player and which era. So, for instance, sometimes Martina Navratilova has said, hey, if I knew that this was all going to come down to major titles, I would have gone and played every major more. I would have emphasized different things. There were periods where a format which is now kind of a low-level exhibition format, which is a shame because it's a lot of fun, called World Team Tennis, which does not count for any tour statistics, was a much more prestigious event, and all the top players played it, and it would conflict sometimes with majors. So at different eras, people made different choices about what they were emphasizing. In every era, people were trying to, at least partially, to optimize for prize money, as long as prize money has been awarded. So that's an interesting one to look at. But a lot of the prize money comparisons out there don't adjust for inflation, let alone for the much greater inflation in prize money in the sport. So, for instance, Novak Djokovic has the most prize money now in the men's sport. But a lot of that has to do with he's been the most dominant for the last 6 years when prize money was higher than when, let's say, Federer or Sampras were on top.
Now, are there people that have tried to kind of adjust for that and almost do like an inflation-adjusted prize money statistic or anything like that?
Yeah, I've seen sort of simple versions and less simple versions, and I think even there you're kind of missing the boat. I mean, if you really want to say, okay, this is just about money, then if you're a player and you're thinking, I'm going to make the most money possible, you don't care if you're making it from prize money, from appearance fees, or from sponsorship. And if the thing that's really going to boost your appearance fees and sponsorship is being famous for being a Grand Slam champ more than anyone else, then you should optimize for that, even if you could pick up all sorts of money elsewhere on tour.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about, you also mentioned the world ranking. That is kind of an interesting concept to me because that includes, you know, different weightings for different tournaments. So you kind of are able to include the lesser tournaments and alongside the Grand Slams, but give more emphasis to the Grand Slams, which seems to be appropriate given what you just said about players' attitudes. But how does that actually work in practice, like when they're creating the world rankings that we hear about?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a lot to like about the rankings. It does account for a lot of what we're describing. So at a simple level, a Grand Slam title counts for 2,000 points. The Masters, which is at next tier, is 1,000. Then this differs from the men's and women's tours, but for simplicity, there's kind of a level below that, which is 500 and 250.
And those numbers are kind of arbitrarily just kind of someone decided that,
yes,
based on how they feel to be importance-wise, I guess?
Yeah, and to some extent, tournaments have sort of been scaled after the fact in terms of like how much prize money they give out and how big their fields are based on what tier they're at. And this has also changed over time. Like if you compare ranking points now to ranking points maybe 15 years ago, they were like half what they are now because all those point totals were half what they are now. And you also get, so if you make the, if you win, you get 2,000. If you make the final on the men's side, you get 1,200. On the women's side, 1,400, and so on back through the rounds.
So Carl, this feels to me like more complex as we implied it would be, but I'm not sure that's bringing me a lot of clarity, which is to say what you're describing feels like it's another way to measure, but not necessarily a better way to measure for me as a casual fan who just wants to understand greatness. If the correlation is large, it may differ of who number one is or who number, you know, three versus four is, for example. But I'm not sure that's going to help me. I'm not sure prize money, given the scheduling vagaries that you mentioned, is really going to help me settle that bar debate that I might get sucked into.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem here is that so much of what's driving this conversation and what's driving the use of all of these measures I mentioned, which I agree are not necessarily better than Grand Slam titles, is that the conversation generally hasn't been empirically driven. It has been barroom debates or even more so online debates. I was reading before the show just an incredibly detailed and complex conversation online in some forum with anonymous people about who's the greatest of all time. And there are hundreds, thousands of these debates, and it happens every day on social media too. People are obsessed with this, but usually, like unfortunately so often in our modern day conversations, it's not about getting to the right answer. It's about who their team is, who is their favorite player, and which measures can I choose that will make the case for that player.
Right. And whereas in other sports, Neil, we talk about a lot on this show, is there are there are attempts at least to have one metric that rules them all in various sports. So wins above replacement, for example, and in baseball, would you say PER is one of those in the NBA or
plus minus would be better.
And part of it is that there are teams there choosing players. So there's a real market incentive to get this right, whereas in tennis, players can't draft another player to help them out.
And therefore, the community doesn't need to create these types of metrics around them is what you're saying?
Yeah, the rankings are mostly useful because it determines who gets into tournaments and where they're seated, and that's important, but it's not nearly as important as, like, who's going to be on my team and who am I going to trade for.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting about the market incentives for it. Okay, so I think I feel ready for the final step.
Yeah. I think so.
Okay. All right, so simplest, career Grand Slams, middle tier, lots of other stuff involving lots of other tournaments and different ways to measure the import of those tournaments, whether it be through ranking points or through prize money or whatever else. Carl, solve it for us. Bring us to the most complex but also most elegant way to measure greatness in tennis.
Well, this is only an intro course, so you know there may have to be...
Classic bait and switch. You just want us to pay for a second level.
Exactly. It's Trump University. There's a higher tier here, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily a solution, but I do think it beats a lot of the earlier methods we mentioned. And that is, guess what, 538 fans, ELO. So ELO is really well-suited to an individual sport like this. ELO is taking into account who you beat and how good they were.
At the time you beat them or not.
At the time you beat them, exactly. So beating Federer at his peak is better than beating him when he was 18. It turns out beating him at 35 is almost his peak, which is just wild. But it's a really elegant way to compare also across eras because there's a continuous flow of competitors in and out of the sport. So Federer never played Pete Sampras, who never played he played Sampras once. But, you know, when Sampras was old and Federer was young, Sampras never played Rod Laver, I'm pretty sure. But they have opponents in common, and you can kind of connect all of those matchups into one overall rating. And it's a pretty fair way to handle it. It does raise some other questions, but should we pause and consider maybe why it beats some of the others?
So ELO ratings, power ratings, as Carl said, about sort of when you play someone and there's points awarded depending on if you win or lose. My understanding in other sports is that there is it doesn't factor in change from year to year for a team, for example. So when we do year to year ELO for a team, it seems odd to start the Dodgers out, or this is a bad example, the Twins out low this year, perhaps because they may have added some people in the offseason and now they might be, and they have been playing better. And so maybe ELO couldn't have seen that coming or their players develop. For tennis, I would think that's not as much of a problem with ELO because it's the same person all the way through.
Yeah, and ELO was developed at first for chess, another one-on-one competition, and tennis also has an almost 12-month calendar, so you really don't have these disruptions and perturbations, and you do get new players flowing in and out, but also you have enough players playing for long enough that you can kind of have these overlapping careers and enough of these matchups to make sense of where players are.
Now, what happens when a player misses huge amounts of time, like Maria Sharapova, for instance, being suspended for, you know, almost a whole season?
Monica Seles, Venus Williams. I mean,
exactly. There's been a lot of players that miss time. What happens there? Is there some kind of like aging adjustment, or do they get docked any points for missing huge chunks of the schedule?
That's a great question. It has come up quite a bit recently, including with Sharapova, as you mentioned. It'll come up with Serena Williams if she comes back, as she promises to after she has her child this year. And this is very cutting edge. It shouldn't be. ELO really should have been applied to tennis for years, but it's fairly recent that this has been happening. Some of it is from 538's Ben Morris, some of it from outside tennis analysts, including Jeff Sackman and Stephanie Kowalczyk. And Stephanie and Jeff have studied the exact question you asked. And it seems like even after a long absence, no matter the reason, players are almost as great when they come back. And if they're not quite at that level, they get back to it pretty quickly. Hmm. That there seems to be some persistence. Now, this is assuming that they are at full strength when they come back. And it could be that they were not at full strength when they left, that they had played some matches while injured, because players are always carrying some injuries. But it is quite notable that for these top players anyway, it does seem like great once, great for as long as you consider yourself able to compete.
So then what are the drawbacks of ELO in this scenario?
So one thing UO struggles with is how do you deal with a player who's entirely new to the system? And this is true in more in individual sports and team sports, though it can come up with an expansion sport too, like where you set them. And if there is sort of like generational improvements over time, that new player who's coming in might be undervalued for a while and players...
But if we're talking about greatness, then I would think that it'll eventually adjust to the greatness. You know, it's rare that we're going to be trying to measure, you know, a two-year on the circuit pro for greatness when you have Federer with 18 Grand Slams that he may be chasing.
Yeah, I agree that's not a big weakness for the use we're talking about. There is also an issue which Federer fans will bring up, so take it with a grain of salt, which is if the field around you is weak, there's only so high you can get in ELO. So especially if it's not taking into account margin of victory, if you beat pretty much everybody but there's no one really great to play or the other great players are inconsistent and you rarely face them, there just aren't that many points you're going
to
pick up.
Serena Williams, I would think that would apply to, especially in the women's circuit over the last 10 years.
Yeah, so Serena Williams fans in recent years would bring that up, and Federer fans in the early part of his career before Nadal, Djokovic et al. Joined have raised this point.
And that seems to be sort of part of the same issue with where you set the incoming players, which is, does it try to take into account these generational differences, or are you only competing against the players that you kind of have in front of you to compete against, or is it trying to do both, and is that potentially a flaw in the system that is kind of, you know, at the same time trying to estimate the depth of the talent pool, but then, you know, you can only pick up points from the other players in your own talent pool, and it becomes kind of circular of how good is the talent pool? Well, we can only judge that by almost who comes in at the bottom, but we're giving them a rating and trying to kind of estimate it at that end.
Yeah, it struggles with this question of are there these different tiers, and is there a tier that's really strong at the top, or is it that the next tier is really weak? It's hard to separate those two and see the difference between them. It is potentially a flaw, although there are also many, many things you can tune about ELO, including, for instance, you could take into account margin of victory. You could do a games-based ELO or a set-based ELO, and people have played with that. You could weight majors more because the players do, or because for the men, best of five is a more meaningful outcome. So there are ways to account for all these factors. Part of the issue is that sometimes what you want to use it for is not necessarily greatest of all time. And if you do want to use it for greatest of all time, it's a debatable question. Do you look at the peak? Is it how good they were at their very best day? Or was it some combination of peak and longevity? Like if you are at, let's say, a 2200 level for 10 years, is that worth more than being at a 2500 level for a year but then having an injury and dropping off?
Well, I was going to say, everything we talked about so far implies you need to have longevity, I think. The Grand Slam major titles, obviously, you got to be playing for a while in order to get a lot. Prize money, total number of titles, similar scenario. And then ELO, I would think you at least need several years of steady success in order to work your way up through the ranks, especially depending on the quality of opponent that you're playing. Is there a way to measure the greatness of a player within a match or within a narrower window, for example? I guess dominance is what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to look at, especially let's say during Wimbledon, where you have, for the men, it's very easy to hold serve. So you could see Federer at his peak would often win a lot of matches like 7-6, 7-6, 7-6. You see a score like that and think he wasn't that dominant. He was lucky to get through. And that's part of the quirks of tennis's scoring system, which we haven't really touched on. We've just been talking about who won or who lost. But what I really like to look at is ratio of returning points that you won to the ratio of returning points your opponent won. Because you basically have to break serve either in games or in the tiebreak more than your opponent does to win the match. And to do that, you have to give yourself the most chances, which is to win returning points.
That's interesting. Yeah, the currency of tennis, it's points, but it's really breaks.
Yeah.
In order to win, you have to have a break at some point,
yep.
Right?
Or at least win a tiebreak, which means breaking serve in the tiebreak as in like winning a point on your opponent's serve in the tiebreak.
Right. And so that's interesting. So therefore, given that insight, if you gear your entire analysis around breaks, then you can start to come up with sort of who is best at the currency of the sport. And this is similar to what happened in baseball around getting on base or wins as
runs,
opposed to, yeah, as runs, yeah,
the important currency
because runs make up the win, and therefore you know you want to know the runs added per game for a player.
Yeah, and you mentioned Wimbledon being kind of different. Is that like a grass court thing, or are there surface based ELOs, and are they different? Do they count? Does each one count the same? Are there penalties for players that like don't play on certain surfaces, or one surface is so much better than the other ones?
Yeah, this is also pretty cutting edge. I mentioned earlier tennis analyst Jeff Sackman. He's been playing with surface ELO recently and found that if you just look at a player's grass court results, you will get better predictive power than if you look at all their results, which is really surprising because many players play 1 out of 8 or 10 matches a year on grass.
Oh, predictions on, say, like clay are also informed grass?
Or? For grass court tennis, do better to throw out 80 or 90% of a player's matches and only look at their matches on grass, which for a player who's maybe only played in their career 10 or 12 matches on grass seems not like what you would want to do. And he's found that if you actually blend overall and surface-based, you'll get better prediction. And we're kind of touching on here what I was saying about ELO can be used for many purposes. It's really valuable for predicting results, and 538 uses it for that too. But the way you might tune it to predict outcomes the best might not be the way that feels the best in terms of like who is the best player right now or of all time.
Okay, so does ELO change who we think is the best?
It could. So for the women, for instance, Monica Seles, depending on how you tune it, it looks like one of the best or the best of all time, but she is a case of someone who peaked very early and dramatically, and she was outdoing her rival Steffi Graf, who's another contender for greatest of all time, and then she was stabbed by a fan on court, missed a lot of time, came back and was great but not as great, and never really reached that level again. So in the other measure, she doesn't compare because of the lack of longevity as a very top player, but in peak ELO, she's a contender. And similarly on the men's side, Novak Djokovic, his career is far from over, and he could still contend in the other measures. He's already top in prize money, but he's 6 majors behind Federer. But in terms of peak ELO, he's well ahead of Federer and was at a level that Federer is unlikely to ever match, even with his great season this year. So it really depends if you look at longevity and ELO and how you sort of tune that. Like, is it points above some level that's sort of great, or is it points above average accumulated over time? It's a tricky question.
But we're at least hearing that this complicates – it gives different answers,
yeah,
perhaps, than the simplest measure does.
And I'm really interested in something that you mentioned, Carl, about the – you know, you can use ELO as something looking backwards, and you can also use it as something looking forward. Are there stats that are being tracked with like cameras or, you know, Hawkeye, any of these like systems that try to measure, you know, the physics of a sport that I think is, you know, one of the most physics based sports that we talk about, that could be even more predictive of, you know, future ability, even if we don't have those stats for historical players, so we can't kind of say what Pete Sampras's stats are in that department, but we could say it for someone like Federer.
Yeah, it's a very exciting future area of research. Stephanie Kowalczyk is a Tennis Australia analyst, and she's done a lot of the work with their Hawkeye data. Part of the challenge in the sport is that each tournament and each federation kind of hogs their own Hawkeye data, so it's not widely available. But she's published a lot of work that explains some of what they're doing with it, and it's fascinating. And you can start to, for instance, group shots into different categories and then say, okay, for different players who hit that shot, how often do they win the point? And how often do their opponents get to the shot? And if, you know, it's sort of like with fielding stats in baseball. If, you know, 20% of fielders would have caught a certain ball and a fielder catches it, that's worth a lot in baseball fielding stats. In terms of overall greatness from those building blocks, that's going to be really tough because so much of tennis is not what is your ability on this particular thing, but how do you put it all together? What is your shot selection? How does that last over a match? How do you adjust to an opponent? So I think as sort of embryonic that research is, even on a shot level, it's even more far from the truth of like what that says about who the best player is.
And it sounds like that could give us almost like players who are more than the sum of their parts and less than the sum of their parts, players that might have like really good talent but just can't win for whatever reason.
Yeah, often that reason being probably their shot selection.
So I want to bring up one last thing. In the recent past on the show, we We talked about the flap between John McEnroe and Serena Williams, which was about whether Serena Williams was the greatest women's tennis player of all time or the greatest tennis player of all time or just the 700th best player of all time if she were on the men's circuit, things like that, or would be ranked 700th, I think is what McEnroe said. And we got an email after that show from a listener named Bo Rottenborn, who pointed us towards something called the Universal Tennis Rating. Have you heard of the UTR, Carl?
I had, and I did some more reading after you sent me that email.
And so does that help us answer? Because we have really continued to keep in two categories here. So would that help us answer some of these questions that often come up around greatness across sex and gender?
Yeah, and also across age and division. So UTR seems like something like ELO. I went on their website, and there's very little details about how they calculate it, and probably there's some commercial reason for that. So it's hard to really deconstruct. But the general concept I love, which is every tennis match at every level is between two people who have also played other people. I used to play in a recreational league in London that was really just a group of people who all put their information on a website and all, you know, recorded their results, and it produced a ranking based on that. And because at so many different levels, players play each other of different ages, of different gender, of different levels, you could actually put together all those results and get a really good idea of what all the levels of the game are and group people who wouldn't normally be in the same group, like an older man and a younger guy and a middle-aged woman, like, could all be at the same tennis level, which is great because sometimes you want a partner to play with and sometimes you're a tournament and you want to have competitive matches. Because it's kind of secretive, I couldn't really make sense of the claim on the Wikipedia page about, like, what Djokovic's UTR is versus Serena Williams, and neither of them have played a player of the other gender in a serious singles match in as long as I can remember. Probably when they were in academies, when they were kids, they did, and maybe that was kept somewhere. But otherwise, it doesn't really make sense to me. But I do love that you could do that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It does seem a little bit like, unless you have that cross-pollination, no matter what answer we approximate, we're never going to quite know. But as we talked about on the show a week or two ago, to sort of say, well, she should be playing against Ben so we can know, cheapens the whole circuit, the women's circuit in the first place.
Well, I'm curious as to what was the ultimate tennis ratings answer to the debate.
It said that Serena perhaps was rated, according to Bo at least, worse than 700th because there were Division I college men's players, for example, who had a higher score than she did.
It wasn't clear where we would be able to compare them just because I don't know of any recorded real matches between Serena Williams and a man. But, you know, I've played with people who, when they were kids, played against Sam Stosur, who has a U.S. Open champion, or Dinara Safina, former number one player. And I've beaten those two players. And I'm definitely not better than Stosur, Safina, or anyone else. But it's like, if you really want to track a player's whole career, then you would get them when they were eight or something, and that doesn't tell you anything about where they are now.
Yeah, it seems a little bit like those college football things where you can actually string together, especially if like an FCS team beats an FBS team through like Appalachian State beating Michigan or something. You could say that whoever was the champion of some lower level was better than you know Miami or someone like that, Ohio State.
Okay, so we've strayed a little bit far from the original prompt, but I'm curious, Neil, after having this full conversation, what feels like the way to measure greatness for you? I have a feeling I know what your answer is going to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think ELO seems like the best of the things that we've talked about. It is interesting because, you know, at the top of the show, Carl, you said that there weren't that many good measures for tennis, which I thought was interesting because we typically associate the sports that have the most data and also the most sort of like reliability of the data or the least randomness of the results with giving us the best, information. So baseball, you know, there's some randomness to the result, but we have huge samples and we have a lot of sample going back and a lot of research on it. And so we feel pretty good about, you know, sabermetric stats. Basketball has, you know, so many trials per game and so many possessions that you can build up a lot of knowledge about players. And so we feel like that might be on equal footing or just about on equal footing with baseball by this point. And tennis is a sport where there's very little randomness to who wins or loses a given match. And so I would have thought that, you know, in tennis we would be able to statistically, you know, have a good feeling about, rankings that we put together based on who wins and who loses. But I don't know. I'm curious about your thoughts on that, Carl.
Yeah, I think as data becomes more widely available and freely available, and a lot of people are attacking this problem, and I got an email from like a physics PhD who has some spare time and wanted to study tennis, I think we are going to get somewhere. I think it's just because of the lack of open data here relative to, let's say, the sports reference websites at Forever Sports, it's just been slower. But yeah, I think there is a ton of potential.
All right. Carl, do you use Elo? Is that your preference?
I think it's the best we've got right now, but figuring out how to turn that into greatest of all time is an ongoing project.
Excellent. I think I'm still leaning number of Grand Slams, I have to say.
It's pretty elegant.
Yeah, and just like Elo can tell me a snapshot of who's best at this moment. I think that I feel good about. But historical legacy terms, I think the championships especially matter in an individual sport. Carl, thanks for doing Stat School, first of all.
My pleasure.
I've learned a ton. If people want to hear more of you talking about tennis, you have a podcast, is that right?
I kind of have two.
Oh my, look at that, double dip.
30 Love and the Tennis Abstract podcast.
Okay, what's the difference between the two for those who are trying to pick, you know, only have room for one podcast?
30 Love is really an interview format, different guest every week. Tennis Abstract podcast is Jeff Sackman and I, and it's very statsy.
Okay.
Why 30 Love? Why that particular score?
Because I liked it, and now I stick to 30 minutes or less for every episode.
Ah, there you go.
That's good. All right. Carl, thanks again for coming on.
Happy to do it.
Okay, that will do it for this week's show. Thanks, Neil, for talking.
Thanks, Chad.
We will be back next week with, I think, another Stat School. I believe baseball is the next Stat School to come. We're going to do a little clip reel. It's the summer.
It's our first clip show.
It's the summer. You know, Possibly. We got lots of vacations to work around, so stay tuned for that, Hot Takedown listeners. Our producer is Katie Ferguson. We got production assistance from Tony Chow this week. 538's podcast intern is Alice Wilder. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app or, of course, at iTunes as well. iTunes.com/538 will bring you to the Hot Takedown page. While you're there, review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.